Okay, here we go. We're starting the Book of Shmos this week, right? And that's that lends with it a lot of new ideas, a lot of new distinctions, new thoughts. And the concept I want to talk about was one line from the Baal Shem Tov. That's all I want to talk about today. One line from the Baal Shem Tov. It's always attributed to the Baal Shem Tov. The truth is it really comes from the Arizal, Rav Yitzchak Luria. A lot of the Baal Shem Tov's Kabbalah, a lot of the Baal Shem Tov's premise of Chassidus is based on the teachings of Rav Isaac Luria in the Arizal. And the Arizal, or the Baal Shem Tov, writes that in Egypt, Das was in Gullus. Dat begullus. What that means is that our minds were in exile. Okay? Das, Dat was in Gullus. Let's just keep it at that. The word Dalet, Ayin Tuf, was in exile when we got to Egypt. So what does that mean? Does it mean we lost our minds? There was no brains? Are we supposed to picture a whole group of people sitting there without their brains? And I want to take that one line, this brief, very esoteric line, which so much has been said on it, but I'd like to study this line from numerous vantage points and what it means. That in Egypt, Das was in Gullus. That our minds were in exile. I think the first possible explanation of what it means that our Das was in exile while in Egypt means that we lost what's called a Hakara. What's Hakara? Hakara means an awareness. We lost a self-recognition, the ability to distinguish and understand who we in fact are. What is our identity? That's what it means, Das was in Gullus. That we lost something very valuable while being in Egypt, and that was the identity of what our people were supposed to be. By the way, that we may have kept external identities. You know, the Medrash says that while in Egypt, Shloshinu Eshmam, they never changed their names, right? Shloshinu as it says their Malbushim, their clothing. Shloshinu, what are the three? They never changed their names, they never changed their language, and they never changed their Malbushim, their clothing. By the way, if you look in the Medrashim, it never really says the line about the clothes. It's not really there. You won't be able to find it anywhere. I don't know how it got in there over the years, but the idea of that is that the Jews kept their external identity. But Das in Gullus means that our internal was obliterated. We had forgotten who we were. We'd forgotten what we stood for. We'd forgotten where we came from. That we came from Avram, Yitzchak, Yaakov, Sarah, Rivka, Rachel, Leah. We forgot all of that. That was what was lost when we say that Das was in Gullus. We lost our identity. And that, by the way, for those who were at the Monday shiur that I gave, know that that was one of the ideas I stressed, that these people were born in darkness, and because of that, they had no sense of self, that we lost our awareness, our homing device. Wadsworth says that habit rules the unreflecting herd. And I think that's the idea here, that we went into autopilot, forgetting that we had some calling. This is just what we do. There's no time to think about bigger calling. You're getting up at 5:30 in the morning. You're asked to build pyramids. You're asked to do backbreaking labor. And then by the time you have a chance to stop, you're out. There's no chance to think about anything. You're out. Whatever time you have down, you're sleeping. And that's the idea of losing Das and Gullus. They lost this ability to be cognizant. There's a teaching from Rav Soloveitchik. This is good for the Haggadah, if you say this for the Seder. Right? The Pesach Seder, we say, Avadim Hayinu. Right? Avadim Hayinu. So, what does it mean, Avadim Hayinu? Or we were slaves in Egypt, right? Why doesn't it say, the way he phrases it, why doesn't it say, Avde Paro Hayinu b'Mitzrayim? We were slaves to Paro in Mitzrayim. Avde Paro. Instead it calls us Avadim Hayinu. But it never calls us Avde Paro Hayinu b'Mitzrayim. So he says a very important point, Rav Soloveitchik, which he uses in a few different places, in a few different contexts, but it's a great drasha, it's a beautiful drasha. Avadim hayinu, we were slaves, just describes what we were doing. You want a job description? What's the job description? Okay, he works at the convenience store. That's the job description. You want to know what we were doing in Egypt? We were avadim, we were slaves. Avadim hayinu. We never became Avdei Paro. You know what Avdei Paro means? It defines, it describes our essence, who we are at our core. When you say Avdei Paro Hayinu, it doesn't just label the job description. It defines who you are. Who are you? I'm Avdei Paro. We are Avdei Paro. That's why the Torah never uses that phrase. It never wanted to let us know that the Jews became possessed or taken over at their core. It's just this first idea. They had forgotten who they really are. They'd forgotten that they're malachim and b'nei malachim. They forgot that they're kings and the children of kings. That's what they forgot. And it's, you know, we all have this. You know, we lose ourselves We lose ourselves in whatever it is we're doing, and we forget that we have a higher calling. We forget that we have a more noble way of living that we're asked to live. And there's these stops in the road of the Jewish cycle of the Jewish holidays and the mitzvos to remind us that you're malachim and you're b'nei malachim. Some things you just don't do. And I think that's a very important distinction of avadim hayinu versus avdei paro hayinu. Calling us avdei paro means it's not a job description. It means we have in fact become that. You know, you have it by Yishmael, right? It calls Yishmael para adam, right? A wild boar of a man, para adam. Para adam, when you have the word para before adam, it's defining what kind of human being he is. What kind of human being is Yishmael? A para adam. It's not just a job description. It's not just a behavior that he was manifesting. That would be adam ha-para. That would be a man who was acting like a wild boar. No, Yishmael was para adam. It defined him. He became that. He became that wild person. It became his essence and reconstructed who in fact he was. You know, there's a great story from Rav Gorelick. You know, one of the big Musar, Bali Musar at Yeshiva University, 50 years ago, was Rav Gorelick. 60 years ago, his name was Rav Gorelick, one of the Rosh Yeshivas. He was known to be very sharp, very strong with the guys. So one of the famous Musar Shmuzim he gave was about the A-Train. For those who know, YU's up in Washington Heights. And in Washington Heights, there is the A-Train. The A-Train is what gets you from Washington Heights into Midtown Manhattan.
Terrible.
What? A terrible train, right? A rough train. Rough train. So the A train, he gave a Musar Shmuz. He says, some of you guys, you know, you talk about how your lives are, you're just getting worse and worse in your lives. So what do? You decide to, you know what? Let me face the other way on the A train. That way I'll be moving up. Whether you're facing this way or that way on the A train, you're still going downtown. You're still moving downtown. And the idea, I think, is the same idea. The idea that we lost that compass of who we are, of what direction we should be going. Thinking that we're making a difference in our life when nothing was happening. It was business as usual every single way. I think this ties into what I said Monday, for those who were there Monday, about Stockholm Syndrome, that in Egypt the Jews had this close, intense affiliation with their oppressor. They felt they owed them something. That's why Jews were resistant to leave. I didn't mention this, that when the Jews were crossing the Egypt, or Shmuel Maliver says, why did they need the waters to close back after the Jews crossed? Right? Make one miracle. The sea split, leave it open. He says, because every Jew wanted to head back to Egypt. And because of that, we needed the waters to... Why would they want to go back to Egypt? Life was terrible there. What we mentioned Monday, Stockholm Syndrome. It's this idea of losing what you're about, and the only thing you know is life as a slave. It's prisoners deal with this. Those who've been in prison for an extended period of time don't have a way to acclimate back on life outside of prison. It's very hard for them to get used to the fact that they have now freedoms again. It's very traumatic and very hard. Certainly someone who's been there for 40 years and then has parole after 40, 45 years. They've got used to a certain way of living and many times don't handle well. They'll get themselves in trouble on purpose at older ages just because they can't handle living outside the walls of a prison. And in a sense, that's what happened to the Jewish people. When we say Das was in Gullus, they bought into a new way of living. You know, they call, you know, in New Age self-help or in the psychology world, they call them memes. Memes is the word. Memes is like these messages. They're internal messages that are passed to us. They're not the self-help idea of messages of, oh, believing what someone told you when you were a kid. I don't mean that. Memes are like subtle cues, sociological subtle cues that define... yes, please.
How do you spell that?
M-E-M-E. That they sort of define... they even create responses in your brain. Meaning after a while you have certain, you know, Pavlovian responses that you do things a certain way, whether habits. The habit always is that I walk out of the house backward. You know, I walk with my back outside to the street. There's certain behaviors that after a while, they become a part of just what we do, and we can't break from them. And in a sense, the Jews had these... This, it's like
you
a virus in the
mind. You can't break from them?
You don't break from them. You can't... Meaning the point is, you can break from anything. You tell yourself that you cannot break from them. Another way of referring to them is called virus of the mind. That's the way some people refer to them, virus of the mind. It's where your mind is possessed by a certain way of living because that's what you know and you think there cannot be another way. And I think that's the first definition of what it means. We're working all up this one statement of the Baal Shem Tov / Arizal, that in Mitzrayim, Das was in Gullus. The first definition, I believe, of what Das was in Gullus means, it means we lost Hakara. We lost awareness of what we are, what we stand for, and our ability to make a difference in the world. That, I think, is the first definition.
Aren't we in the same position now?
Yes.
Completely.
In many ways, yes.
You know, I was really stunned. There's a professor, Professor Menachem Fish, over at Tel Aviv University. I don't know if you've heard of him.
No.
His father was rector of Bar Ilan.
Okay.
He's a major Zionist, you know, who believed that we should have the entire land of Israel and everything. And somehow he got involved, as many academics in Tel Aviv do, you know, Tel Aviv University, in this whole pro-Palestinian movement.
Of course,
and was
the
on
left.
This major, like this group of Israeli academics. You know, a lot of them are very leftist. And until 2009. And then, of course, he finally saw the light. And he's a major philosopher. So he published this whole book.
Well, that's a problem. Listen, it's a problem. It's endemic to the left, because the left has a worldview, a utopian worldview. They want to see, and that's the positive. You want to see the world as being perfect. You want to see things as being perfect, as that there's no need for war. There's no need for walls. There's no need for keeping a people separate from other people. There's no need for, you know, we can live in a utopia. Those on the right believe that utopia is not possible in this world. We're always working towards it, and every behavior we do has to work towards it. But you're not in it right now, and so long as you're not even in it, you have to live in a different reality. It's the equivalent of saying, I will leave all my doors open because I believe in the beauty of humanity. I will sleep every night with my doors wide open because humanity is beautiful. Humanity has a terrible track record. We have a terrible track record, humanity. We can't say humanity is a beautiful thing. There are beautiful humans, but humanity, all in all, has done a lot of terrible in the world. Yes?
Yeah, I don't find the statement so surprising. Like, the first generation that was slaves, so they had a taste of being Jews. But their children, who were born into slavery,
yeah,
second generation, why should they think
In sociology, it's called the theory of the severed flower.
Yeah, I mean, they didn't have anything that would show them a different
There was no
world.
Link.
So why should they have
Right, in sociology, it's called the theory of the severed flower. Now, when you have an atheist, so one level is able to retain many of the values of the previous generation. But the next generation is nothing holding on anymore, and it withers, yeah.
So he published this book right
Oh, sorry, go ahead, yeah.
Yeah. And in his book, he's a philosopher.
He
claims that people have no way to be able to be objective about reality.
That's scary.
He didn't say,
that is
I'm sorry
scary.
For what
I send me a link.
Sorry,
please send me a link. I love that idea.
Yeah, I read it.
That's Rav Dessler and Michtav Meliyahu writes at length about our netiyos, that sometimes we have certain, meaning why do we go to a Rav for, by the way, if you know context, Rav Dessler was very much in favor of the concept of Das Torah, the concept that Rabbanim can weigh in areas beyond their expertise, in areas beyond halacha. And one of the main reasons why he was an advocate of Das Torah position was that we believe the whole nature of Torah is that it, your engagement with it is the best shot humans have of peeling away biases. It's the best shot we have. It's not perfect because humans are still flawed, but it's the best shot we have at clearing away biases. And because of that, that's why the Gadol, so to speak, is more removed from a predisposed bias. But we know that's not always the case. Not everybody, and you got to figure out who's included in that.
So how does Torah protect us, and why wasn't Bnei Israel protected from? Why weren't they able to overcome?
By the way, if you look at this, they were missing the one thing which allows us to have recognition and awareness of who we are as a people. It was missing that we have a Torah. The Jews did not have a Torah yet. I say this all the time. People go to Israel, right? And you see this all the time, this movement of when kids go after high school to Israel. And for a time being have this religious revival or this renewal. And many times, it flip out. And then sometimes those who flip fast, flip even faster back when they come back. And then some continuously grow and work on themselves or come to a place in the middle where they mature. But I see the pattern over and over and over. It's going to be a short-lived experience if when you came back from your Israel high, so to speak, you were not able to learn on your own. Because without your Torah, meaning while you're in Israel, why are you having these experiences? These are pick-me-ups. You know, you can go to the Rebbe or the Rebbetzin's house for Shabbos, or you can go to the Kotel. And you could have these experiences which pull you along, but if you don't have the Torah at the end of the day to anchor yourself, you don't have a shear at the end of the day to keep you anchored and grounded, you have nothing that could last, that you could hold on to. And I think the Jews in Mitzrayim did not have a Torah yet. They had concepts. They had ideals. They had experiences that were supposed to be passed along, stories of their legacy and who they were. And those, Rabbi Nachman says, right? People tell a story. People in the world tell stories to put people to sleep. In Judaism, we tell stories to wake people up. I love that. And we had our stories, and that's what we should have been telling each other. We should have been telling our stories. That was our Torah up to that point. The Torah doesn't begin with the first mitzvah, HaChodesh Hazeh Lechem. The Torah begins with the stories, and that's where it all starts. Okay, I think the second possible explanation of what it means that while in Egypt, Das was in Gullus, that our minds were in exile. What does it mean? So it's not just awareness, but it's also about shivisi, shiviti. It means alignment. Alignment. Sometimes we're just misaligned from what we should be doing. It's not that we don't have an awareness. You know how you go to the, sometimes when you go to like to Disneyland or whatever, they have that game where you could shoot the water in the hole and the thing goes all the way up and the first one to hit the buzzer wins. My wife's the best at that. So you have that thing where you got to aim right in the middle and the thing goes up. So you see, you look at someone off to that's usually me, and the thing is like 4 inches way off and you're wondering, what in the world are they doing? That's misalignment. They know what they got to do. They understand how the bell gets to the top and you win the big bear. But for some reason, you're misaligned. You're aiming here when the thing is over there. And that's shivisi. That's shivisi.
Maybe it wasn't important for you.
What? No, no, it's not. Hell of a vibe. I did want that bear. Okay. So the philosopher Chesterton once said an amazing thing about the lesson of Beauty and the Beast. What's the great mushal of Beauty and the Beast? So he says like this, the lesson of Beauty and the Beast is that something must be loved before it is lovable. Meaning, say differently, a person must be loved before that person can be lovable. And in a sense that you have to know that God accepts you for who you are. And once you start with that alignment between you and God, then you can move forward. Only then can you move forward. Once you understand that you're someone worthy of love, can you actually be loved? And without that, you see it all the time. You see people who have such low self-esteem, such a poor concept of self, they become nasty people. It's like the two are tied together, but they're not. They're two independent things. People who are often nasty and it becomes, oh, because of insecurity. What does insecurity have to do with them being nasty people? Because the two feed into each other. From that insecurity, from that lack of sense of self or that self-worth, comes this position that I can't be loved. I'm not going to be loved. I am unlovable. I am unlovable. And that's the alignment we're talking about. The Jewish people had lost such a sense of self, and the first thing we said, a sense of akara, such a sense of self, such a sense of self-worth, that there was no way to align themselves with God. There was no way. There was simply no way. It's the kids you see you have the most difficulty with. You know, we always thought the kids you're going to have difficulty with in a school or in a high school are the ones you have problems sometimes with kids who have entitlement issues, who they get everything and they never hear a no. But you know what? More, I'm telling you right now, from the years that I taught high school, the problems more often than not were not necessarily the spoiled kid. It was not the kid who was given everything. The problem was the kid who had a low sense of self-worth. The problem was the kid who walked away thinking that they are worthless, who parents never told them they're great, or whatever experience they had, they never saw in themselves a sense of self. And because of that, it's almost impossible to align themselves with God. Why would God care about someone who can't stand themselves? Why would God care about someone that no one else in the world cares about? And that creates this misalignment. There's a great book out there. It was a big book on metaphysics in the 30s by Yule Anderson. It's called Three Magic Words. Three Magic Words. And the book, he's stringing you along the whole book. So you're wondering, what are these three magic words? What are these three magic words? So the end, the last three words are as follows, is I am God. Now it's very, lahavdil, almost sounding Buddhist-like and pantheist, I am Hashem and all that. I'll rephrase it based on our Jewish sensibility and our sense of the tradition from the Baal Shem Tov and tradition from Rav Dessler. Leis Iser panoi mine. Four words. They're called four magic words. There is no place devoid of God. Leis atar panoi mine. It's a line from the Zohar. There is no place devoid of God. You want three words? Ein od milvado. There's nothing besides God. that creates alignment, where you realize that wherever you're going, wherever you are in life, it's one of my favorite Divrei Torah. I heard from the Kalava Rebbe. Kalava Rebbe said to me, "Shal Malecha Me'al Raglecha Ki Amakom Asher Ata Omed Alav Admas Kodesh." I'm sure I quoted with you that when Moshe was by the burning bush, God says, "Remove the shoes from your feet because where you're standing is holy ground." So the Kalava Rebbe said it to me. I thought he wanted me to remove his shoes because I'm standing in front of him. He says, "No." He said, "No. Shal Malecha Me'al Raglecha. You can remove the shackles from your feet if you realize that no matter wherever you stand in life is holy ground." And that's alignment. It's realizing that no matter where you are, no matter what position where you are, kol ha-makom asher ata omed alav, wherever you stand, is admas kodeshu. That's holy ground. That's the idea of alignment. That's the idea of alignment. And what we did was, because of this misalignment, we've limited God's ability to change our physical situation. Whatever we're facing right now, whatever we're dealing with right now in our lives, some things, you know what, you try and you can't do. But we make God a lot smaller than God is. Doesn't mean at the end of the day, Einhorn ever would have became an NBA basketball player. We don't believe in the concept that anything is, if you believe, we don't believe in the book, The Secret? The Power of Positive Thinking, Vincent Norman Peale. We believe in the power of positive thinking, but I'll tell you, we don't believe into it to the extent of what it's made out to be. You could be sitting in traffic and suddenly break traffic because you think positively. On the contrary, I remember speaking to a doctor who works at Sloan Kettering in New York, which essentially treat cancer patients, and he says, "This book, The Secret, is driving him crazy." I said, "Why?" He says, "Because we need our patients to feel a sense of nervousness and anxiety so they know to come back in when they need to come back in for a scan. If everything is power of positive thinking and it's going to be great and it's all good, no one's going to stop and say, 'Let me get checked.' No one's going to stop and say, 'Maybe something's wrong,' because power of positive thinking." So we believe in the power of positive thinking, but I just have to understand, it's within a certain framework of what God wants for us. It's within a certain framework of what God says yes. Meaning, I would rephrase it. It's not that anything is possible, but what we thought is not possible is actually possible. You understand the difference? That's a much more Jewish way of looking at it. It's not anything is possible, but the things we thought are impossible, many of them are usually possible. And the problem is because of this misalignment. We've limited God's scope of our lives. God's there in shul, but outside of shul, that's it. And I say, by the way, because of that, that creates much of the problems of why, in some level, women feel. I spoke about this that night when I had that four rabbi panel at Shul Heaven. Talked about women's role in the tefillah service. And I felt that I think part of what creates this tension for women in the prayer service, in their exclusion thereof in the leadership of the tefillah itself, is because we've made the shul the epicenter for all Judaism. All religious experience happens in shul. And if the very center of where all religious experience is happening in shul, and women are playing a secondary role, then yes, I'm going to be pretty ticked off. Yes, I'm going to feel offended and left out. But if you understand that the shul was never supposed to occupy the place in Judaism that it occupies now, go look for a shul inside the Chumash. Yes, you have a base of Mikdash, and a shul might be a commemoration of a Mikdash Me'at, but so is a home, so is a table, so are many mitzvot, so are thousands of things. And when we replace the shul as the only place for the experience of God and the experience of Judaism, that creates this tremendous tension in our lives. On all levels, and it also emphasizes that the people who might not find the most meaning in shul, they're the least religious, they're worthless, because we've defined that as the main place. And if you can't make it to, and all of a sudden you feel less of yourself because you can't make it to davening or don't feel it in shul. But we did that. We ruined the whole, we've been ruining the system by flipping the two around. And the point of Shavisi Shem L'Negi Tamid, alignment, is to teach us that God is with us in all areas, to break down the walls. Yes.
So I was wondering if you could explain how the problem, you were saying something about how the problem for in Egypt was limiting God's power in their life, but then it also, earlier you said, it didn't say that the Jews were slaves to Paro. So I thought it was interesting, like that.
They were slaves to Paro as their job, but it never redefined who they were as a people. As a people, they deep down, latent in their subconscious, was a concept that we are a people of nobility. However, Das was in Gullus, and they could not access that reservoir. And because of that, they misaligned themselves. They were not aligned with God. You know, we say they couldn't listen to Moshe because of the Kotzer Ruach. Mi Kotzer Ruach ome avodah kasha. From the hard work and the shortness of spirit. What does that mean, Kotzer Ruach? I think this is what Kotzer Ruach means. they constricted the ruach in them. Where did the ruach come to them? Where's ruach come to us? Vayipach be'apav nishmas chaim. God blew into us the breath of life. Ruach is the breath of life. It's our vitality given to us from God. And because of all the work and because of this misalignment, we could not access. You ever see how you feel spiritually on a hard day or when things are not good or you get some bad results or whatever it is, whatever you find out when something's not going well? So yes, some people find that their most spiritual tefillah ever. But as far as practicing Judaism on a, you know, a minute-by-minute level, doing this mitzvah, doing that halacha, it becomes very hard when there's a kotzer ruach. When there's a kotzer ruach, your mind is totally consumed by that which is facing you, an upcoming prognosis, an upcoming result. And because of the kotzer ruach, you're unable to focus on what you need to do. That's why Rav Volbi says that when a boy in yeshiva has these moments of kotzer ruach, where he's going through stress, don't beef up the amount of hours you're going to learn Torah. That's the time to take it down a notch and cool down and keep a base level amount of observances so that you don't have this tension where you're feeling so dark right now and you're feeling so depressed and your mind's going to associate your mitzvah observance and your extra learning with what you're feeling right now. So you need to pull back. By the way, it's a big mistake. You find this often. It is pointed out in the book, the follow-up to the book, Men Are From Mars, Women Are From Venus. He wrote a bunch of books in between. Gary, I forgot his name, Gary something. But there was one good one many books later. He has, I forget the name of it, but it's all the science-based proofs of the concepts of men are from Mars and women from Venus. And he argues in there, he says there's something that women do all the time. When women go into stress mode, what they do is to try to prove that they're not in stress mode, or some women try to prove, look, I'm in stress mode, they go into overdrive, as opposed to doing what it is they need to most, and that is just pull back. Just pull back. A guy, when he's in stress mode, will often just shut down and totally check out. But a woman will go the opposite extreme. She'll overdo, you know, invite triple the amount of guests. She'll overdo whatever to prove, either to prove that I'm not in stress look, or to prove this is what stress looks like. And he says she needs the opposite. She needs to pull back from it. And that's the kotzer ruach. So the kotzer ruach.
The statistics on this?
He had all. He took the whole premise of his book was to show everything is brain based. The differences in relationships are all brain based, and the compulsion and how we handle stresses, the differences between men and women handle stresses are all brain based. I didn't check up his research. That's the point of his book. Okay. So regardless, mikotzer ruach is the same idea.
What is this word? How do you translate that word?
Mikotzer ruach. Ruach is spirit.
But what about the other word?
Kotzer, shortness of spirit. So from the hard labor, from the avoda kasha and the kotzer ruach, we were unable to access this great depth.
It's not
yes.
Constriction?
What?
It's not constriction.
Katsar, yeah. Shortness. Shortness. Katsar is something. Mitzrayim is constriction. That fits nicely with all this. Mitzrayim is metzar. Metzar is a constriction. It suffocates. You can't breathe. You can't breathe. That's what, it's all ties together. It's one to the other. Das was in Gullus. What does that mean? They couldn't recognize who they were anywhere. They couldn't breathe. They couldn't be themselves. Because they couldn't be themselves, they were totally misaligned and fell off. You know, that medrash that says they had opposite jobs. The Egyptians used to give the men women jobs and women men jobs. What was that about? Again, it's misalignment. You're not you. You're not living you. And when you're not living you, something's off. When you try to become something you're not, you feel that disruption, that dissonance in your life. And I think that is the second pshat. And what it means, das was in Golis. I'll say a little more in the second thing. Kavana. You know what the whole idea of kavana? What does it mean to have kavana when you did you have kavana? What does it mean? It doesn't mean did you feel it. Have kavana means kivun. Kivun means direction. What do you mean direction? Are you aligned? That's why we have this thing of facing east. You're supposed to face Yerushalayim, sometimes facing west, depends where you're standing. But you're supposed to face Yerushalayim. Why? Because that's the kivun. That's the direction. It's about aligning yourself. You know what you do with the Gemara says if you're on a horse and you can't get down because it's dangerous. You can't get down. You can't turn the horse around. You're on a boat or you can't turn around. What do you do about davening? So you know what the Gemara's Mishnah says? In your heart you face Yerushalayim. Because at the end of the day, the body is just trying to get your emotions into it. That's why you do it. But it's really about the internal. It's about aligning yourself. It's about finding that shavisi, that alignment, that proportional direction. And sometimes our misalignment comes because in our lives we have no room for God. We make no room in there for God. It's a great idea. I don't know if you ever read What you know, Odysseus. What's the book with Odysseus and you know, is
the Iliad.
Iliad. Thank you. The Odyssey. I'm talking about the Odyssey here, not Iliad. Yeah. In the Odyssey, there's a great part where he's in a cave, stuck there with Polyphemus, who is the what do you call the one eye? The what's a one eye?
The Cyclops.
Cyclops. Thank you. He's stuck with Polyphemus, the Cyclops, in a cave, and he's figuring, how the heck am I going to get out of here? Polyphemus is killing one by one, and Polyphemus turns to him and says, "So Nu, what's your name?" So he doesn't want to give him his name. He knows once he gives him his name, he'll create this bond, and he's finished. He can't get out. So he says, "My name is Nobody," right? So he says, "My name is Nobody." Okay, fine. They create this amazing idea. They give them wine and drink and everything. And while the Cyclops is asleep, while Polyphemus is asleep, so he starts piercing his eyes while he falls asleep. All of a sudden, he wakes up the his eye. While he wakes up, the Cyclops is screaming out loud to his friends, the other Cyclopses who are outside the cave, but stuck from coming in. He's screaming out to them, "Ow, I'm screaming." They go, "What's wrong? What's wrong?" They go, "Nobody's hurting me. Nobody's hurting me." Because he told him his name is Nobody. "Nobody's hurting me." And he's trying to tell the other Cyclops that nobody's... So they're like, "Oh, he must be fine. Forget it. Nobody's hurting him." And they walk away. And what you learn from that, I think the yesod of that is a tremendous one, that when you face the problem of an overblown ego... Sometimes an overblown ego creates tremendous problems for you in your life. You get angry at everyone. You can't stand why something happened to you or didn't happen for you. The best escape sometimes from an overblown ego is being nobody. Sometimes being nobody is the best escape from that overblown ego. And I think that's the lesson, that idea. And that also plays into how we realign ourselves. We need to align ourselves. And getting to a place of Ein Od Milvado. There's nothing else besides God. There's nothing else. That realization. Sometimes it's about realizing greatness. And sometimes it's about realizing it's not always about you. I'll say one more idea like that. You know, you're supposed to do the Noam Elimelech. My wife is descended from the Noam Elimelech, Rebbe Elimelech of Lezhensk. There's this skula that when you go into labor, you're supposed to learn the Noam Elimelech, right? So in the Noam Elimelech, it says the following. Beautiful idea. We say it in Hallel. You know what we say in Hallel? We say, Pisku li share shamayim, open for me the gates of heaven. Zeh tzadikim yavovo, zeh hashar la Hashem tzadikim. This is the gate to Hashem. The tzadikim go through it. This is the gates of Hashem that the tzadikim go through it. So the Noam Elimelech points to a problem in that line that we say all the time in Hallel. Look at this problem. It's a beautiful problem. Piskuli, open for me the gates of heaven. That's the gate that the tzaddikim go through. So we read it usually as, open for me the gates, the ones that the tzaddikim are always passing through. I want there. Noam Elimelech says, that's not how you read it. That's not what it says. It's saying, the open for me, that's the gate that the tzaddikim go through. What does that mean? What does it mean to be a tzaddik? It means that the more you learn, the more you realize how little it is you actually know. The more you get close to God, the more you realize, wow, the vastness of God in this world. That gate of saying, God, open for me. I haven't touched anything. That's already the gate that the tzaddikim pass through. You understand? The tzaddikim don't pass through the gates of heaven. We all go eventually, God willing, to heaven, Shari Shemayim. No, the gates of God, please open something for me. I feel like I know nothing. It's when you get to the place where you feel like you know nothing, that's when you know that you're in the gates of where the tzaddikim are. That's the gate. The gate of where you need some God to open, that's when you feel like you're there. That's when you're feeling there. The Zohar says, based on the Pasuk, Lo yireni adam v'chai, that no one could see me and live. No one could see me and live. Right? The inference is though that if you're dying, then you could see God. No, it's that feeling. It's that feeling that I have no way to see God. It's that angst that I want it so badly that there's nothing else to see. And I close with this idea, that this wasn't just the Yetzias Mitzrayim for a people. This was for Moshe as well. Remember, Moshe was Ani Aral Svasayim. Moshe was circumcised of tongue, of lips. He couldn't speak. He had these limitations. What did God show him? God showed him that if you're aligned with me, no limitation in the world could hold you back from what you need to do. By the way, that's also a proper hashkafa. You might not be able to solve what is your problem, but if you align yourself with God, you'll realize how you're supposed to do what it is you need to do, even though you may have that problem. Again, what you thought are your limitations are not your limitations. What you thought were your limitations are not necessarily your limitations. And I think these two ideas will continue of what it means, Das and Gullus. There's seven or eight other ways of explaining it. But just these two are powerful enough. Number one, it means that we lost the recognition of who we are. And number two, it's a misalignment. And I think they both testify to the two levels that we're all supposed to live on. Of Anochi Afar Ve'efer. I'm a nobody. I'm supposed to live as a nothing, as a nobody. It's not all about me. But we're also supposed to live as Bishvili Nivra Olam. The world was created for me. A Jew lives with both coins, one in each pocket, as Rav Simcha Bunim of Peshiska says. So we'll stop there this week. We'll stop there, Mitzvah. We're not on...